Welcome to the Digital Euro Podcast by the Digital Euro Association. In this podcast, you will learn about the disruption of technology in the monetary and financial system. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to all of you in the audience, as well as to our great panelists for today. On behalf of the Digital Euro Association, we're truly happy to have you with us today. We're going to be discussing questions around the general role of money in times of crises, CBDCs as a defense mechanism, and whether it is the state's responsibility to issue a digital form of money in times of crises. A special thank you goes out to all of our supporting partners and our gold partner Ripple. Just as a heads up for anyone in the audience, we will have a Q&A session for Katarina's presentation right after her presentation on the eHirvnia and a Q&A session after the panel discussion itself, in which we'll then extend your questions to our panelists. And what you can actually do is include the name of the panelist you want to direct the question at in your question, and that way we'll be able to address that person directly. And to submit your questions, please use Slido, so not the YouTube chat, but Slido, either by following the QR code that you can see here or by opening Slido and then typing in the number 6423, and that way you'll be able to submit your question. Now, before we will listen to Katarina's presentation on the Ukrainian National Bank CBDC project, the eHirvnia, I would like to introduce all of our great panelists for today, starting with Caroline Hill. And Caroline Hill is the Director of Global Policy and Regulatory Strategy at Circle. Prior to her time at Circle, she focused on money laundering, terrorist financing, and sanctions policy at the US Treasury Department. As for Circle, Circle is the sole issuer of the stablecoin USDC, as probably most of our audience knows. And as of June 1st, there was over 54 billion US dollars in USDC in circulation and over 4 trillion USDC transferred on chain. Really great to have you with us today, Caroline. Next up is Glenn Kim. Glenn Kim is the Managing Director of Strategic Business Development at Fluency. And Glenn Kim himself has over 30 years of experience as a government and central bank financial advisor, investment banker, and entrepreneur in tech and financial services. As for Fluency, Fluency focuses on creating a DLT-based CBDC platform that central banks can utilize to set up their own individualized CBDC networks. And you can already see a bit of the footprint, let's say, that our panelists bring to the table. So already very diverse perspectives. So more of the regulatory side and then more of the entrepreneur and tech company perspective. And our next panelist is no exception to this rule. It is Dr. Cyrus de la Rubia. And since 2005, he is the chief economist at Hamburg Commercial Bank. And he has more than 20 years of experience in the area of financial markets. One of his research focuses lies on digital money and its implications for the economy and the society. And you can actually stay tuned because this book about the new variety of money focusing on cryptocurrencies and CBDCs will be available from September 2022 on. So that's not too far off at all. As for the Hamburg Commercial Bank, they are a specialist financier headquartered in Hamburg. So as the name leads to believe, that's in Germany. And the bank's mainly involved with commercial real estate, international shipping, renewable energy, digitalization, and corporate finance as, let's say, their main pillars. And their portfolio also involves domestic and international payment transactions and trade finance. And last but certainly not least, our actually the way I'd like to frame her is more the guest of honor is Katarina Zapska. Great to have you with us today as well. Katarina is the head of innovation projects at the National Bank of Ukraine and project manager for national CBDC projects, and that being the eHirvnia. With more than 9 years of experience at the central bank, her main focus is on CBDC. FinTech and payment innovations, or it was in the past. So that's touching on things such as QR codes and IPS, for example. And She worked on CBDC design since 2017, and that included research, study of international experience, and the likes. Now, as a project manager for the eHernia, she leads a cross-functional team at the National Bank covering product design, IT, security, financial stability, and monetary policy, and reconciliating with external stakeholders as well, actually. Great to have you with us. So as you can see, it will be a very varied discussion, given that we have national bankers, commercial bankers, someone with a policy and regulation perspective, and someone from a private economy tech company with us today. But before turning to today's panel discussion, we will turn it over to Katarina now for a presentation on the Ukraine CBDC project, the eHernia. The floor is all yours, Katarina.
Hello, everyone, again. Good afternoon and good morning, depending on where you are. With the colleagues from the DIA, we decided before to make the practical case explanation just before our panel discussion. And I believe it would be interesting. We will have it quite briefly. At the same time, we will leave some few minutes for the Q&A session. I hope you can hear and see me well, because it was written that my internet connection is poor, but I hope that it's okay. So I will tell you about our Ukrainian case for the central bank digital currency, in a particular eHryvnia, which stays for like electronic hryvnia. Hryvnia, as you understood, is our national currency. What about the slides there? Yeah, moving. That's very nice. I will briefly bring you to the history. So what has been done, then I will explain where we are and what our plans for the next, for the future. So it was seen that the National Bank of Ukraine was one of the pioneers in this topic. And since 2016, we have their research on a permanent basis dedicated to the CBDC topic. So we've been really in a very intense international cooperation in contact with the colleagues from the different central banks, from the IFIs. And then at a certain point, we feel the need. We also got these ideas from the private market, and we decided to perform, we call it the pilot project. Nowadays, we can call it the first pilot project because we are looking for the second one. Even though me personally, I believe that it was the more the building up the prototype, I will tell you a bit more why. So our first pilot that was conducted in 2018 was covering different aspects. It was the practical issuance of the retail CBDC in a closed environment. So we took one of the available version of the blockchain protocol and issued limited amount of the retail CBDC. The access for this electronic hryvnia were only to the employees, testing group of the employees of the National Bank of Ukraine. Even though at that time we call it a pilot, nowadays when this frame is more clear, when IMF and other international financial institutions defined more clearly different stages of the researches of the CBDC, I believe that we should call it a prototype. So, of course, at this prototype, we had a very big like practical experiment. Even we developed the applications for the different like iOS and Android. We test different type of operations. So it was the issuance, it was the redemption, of course, it was the P2P transaction, it was certain type of merchant transactions. We tested how the ledger itself works, where the nodes are, and what are the benefits of the different models of the operational model. Then starting from the operational model, we started to study together with our private sector and with our financial market, the business model. Apart from this, we of course analyzed the macroeconomic effects and the effects on the financial stability. Of course, in the focus of our prototype building on the pilot, as we used to call it, the legal aspects were fully covered. At that time, as any country, Ukraine at that time, also we have no regulation and even like slight understanding what CBDC is, and it of course depend on the model. So at that time, we took the regulation of our electronic money that allows us and give us the legal rule as the central bank to issue this. Of course, together with the technical, like different testing possibilities that already been mentioned, the big area of work were done with the international partners. For example, the technical part of the solution were also tested by the World Bank Innovative Lab, which brought us to the more deeper understanding and more concerns. So they help us to address the drawbacks of the potential solution and how it should be improved in case of scalability. But of course, any CBDC is like any innovation, is any product is coming from the policy goal. So what was our policy goal? At that time, we were thinking that we would address by our CBDC, by issuing CBDC, first in a testing environment, then with the potential for scalability, the financial inclusion. But our outcomes of the pilot brought us to the understanding that it's not absolutely clear, and it's more questions than answers. So how it would work if it could really address, and maybe not at all, the financial inclusion? And then what should be the case to solve the real problem of our market, particularly not in general, because motivation to introduce CBDC for each country they varies, as we may see from the big pilot and the experience of the countries who already introduced. So we continue our search as we understood that we need a very close cooperation with our private market. So we need to engage them more. For this, we performed the big international conference, which was at that time one of the first one where we brought the private market participant. So we brought the all key players from our financial market and fintech market to make them aware, because you know at that time, even for many people from the classical banking or financial services, the CBDC was something very theoretical and unclear. So it would be hard to expect some feedback from them on the aspect that is completely terra incognita for them. So we start this involvement with the conference. After that, in a year, we performed the market survey that was addressing the experts from the financial sector. We pre-developed six potential models that in our guesses, according to the our feeling and understanding, but of course as a regulator, we don't have much and complete. So we predefined this like a scheme, this where experts could address and find what is the belief more attractive for the consumers. So where is the high demand and potential for our CBDC is lying. This is really help us to define the further steps, like predefine the further models and continue our work in a very dedicated areas, which I will cover now. It was seen also that in the meantime, Ukraine were adopting the Payment Service Directive, second Payment Service Directive, and the Parliament were considering this draft law on payment services that was the implementation of PSD2. And in this law, we also include the norm where we define what is CBDC. What is CBDC for Ukraine? So it's like a very high level definition, and it simply reserves the right of the central bank to issue the central bank digital currency. Of course, all other like sub-regulations and regulatory frameworks should be developed upon the use cases. But at the end of the day, we are already having this big and high level norm in our legislation. So survey, our internal study, our cooperation with international partners, and of course the engagement with the private sector, not only via the survey but via the discussions, allow us to predefine the three potential use cases which should be in the focus of our further study. And nowadays it is the three of them that we expect to study more. So it is our CBDC or our electronic hryvnia for the retail cashless payments, but in this case for the retail payments we considering it only with the and with this extra benefits like programmed money that could be used in the targeted social payments or law that could be used by the second level of financial market, developing the really new financial product to the end users. It is the one and first use case. The second, but less, it's not less important for our country, is the CBDC in the circulation of virtual assets market. It was saying, and maybe the participants have heard, that Ukraine already, like our parliament, passed the law on the virtual assets. It not yet came in force, but we expect to happen this really soon. And on the one hand, it's really a big benefit and area of the potential. On another hand side, of course, it's a lot of challenges in this area. That's why we believe that issuing the our CBDC for these matters, like exchange, so then when the hryvnia would serve as a payment instrument, for example, or if in the future we can test it as a collateral for the issuance of some particular virtual asset, it could really benefit, at least in the level of study it should be done to understand how this could work in the future, for example. The third case, last but absolutely not least, and I believe one of the most prominent in the global and long scale, long-term scale, is the CBDC for the cross-border payments, because cross-border payments still has lots of frictions. They take a lot of time. They are very costly. They have a lot of levels of intermediaries. So it should be anyway addressed by some instrument. And in this case, of course, there are a lot of practical experiments happening in the world, most of them under the BIS Innovation Hub patronage, but not only, and it's something that's really very prominent, I believe. Just to sum up, I will also describe where we are at the moment, because taking into account that we started really earlier and maybe a bit rushed up in this some case, nowadays we are taking more like a well-balanced approach. And with this well-balanced approach, we started first the building the idea, finding these all goals, defining the case, only after that developing the proof of concept prototype, and only then looking for the pilot, and only then looking to the even finding this answer whether we should issue on a big scale. So at the moment we are on a theoretical phase. We are building the concept for all these three cases. We are like keeping them in focus so that this theoretical good background would allow us to make the issuance and the second pilot really addressing the real pains of our market and really benefit our consumers and users with this innovative instrument as a CBDC. So it was it for my presentation. Here are my contact. If you want to connect and stay in touch, please welcome. And also, I believe we have some minutes for the questions. Potentially, Sarah, you would manage this.
Yes, perfect. Thank you so much, Katarina. It's always refreshing to hear from national banks that are quite blockchain inclined, like the National Bank of Ukraine, actually, coming from the Eurozone. That is, of course. And we do indeed have a couple of questions related to the presentation that you just gave. And the first one that I'd like to raise is, what exactly is a social payment? So I think that was mentioned on the three different boxes on one of your slides.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to go back to the slides, but unfortunately the presentation seemed to be frozen. But it was in the case of for the retail payments. And yes, we're looking into the retail payment instrument with the programmability. And talking about the social payments, we are talking about the disbursement. So G2P payments on the one hand side, because Ukraine already had something similar, when we have like support from the government for certain matters and for certain group of the population. And for example, this money, they should be programmed because they are limited. Like if it is support for the newborn kid, it should be only spent for the goods that are really needed by this newborn kid. Of course, the traditional payment instrument could help to implement this. But what we found in our program of the support that was called like Yepitrimka, that the traditional instruments are not fully functioning, and it's really, they are not addressing the issue, because of the many aspects how they operate. Like, it's quite a long story to talk about, but also in this case it is the potential for the reverse side. So for example, if the programmability is allow some certain type of payments that are P2G, like paying tax, could be automated with this programmability function of the CBDC.
Okay, I think that answered the question really well, what a social payment is. So there's some parallels to CBDCs that have already launched there that have more of a voucher approach as well, or could have, which is leading me to my next question, actually, that was also asked. So given the current situation, and of course, we're very, very sorry that currently the situation in Ukraine is as terrible as it is, truly, how has the war influence the design features that you're considering for the eHervnia? Is there anything you could mention?
Yeah, it's really a very interesting question. Because, you know, our innovative stream of work also on the CBDC, and we hope that even all the deadlines that we planned before this terrible war, they would be met. At the same time, of course, we understand that the new challenges that brought this terrible war, it could reshape our minds. Like, for example, I would give you just one example. We've been not considering offline, for example, at all, because it's very high, like even compared to the developed countries. And even more, we had the state program to enhance it up to 99.5% of coverage of our entire territory. But nowadays, we understood that offline could give this extra mechanism that could address some aspects. But at the same time, it was saying that we are still working on all the design features. And it's like, you know, it's our guesses and that are at the moment at our table. And what I also told you before, that we are working very close with our private market, because we believe without the participants from the private market, we cannot feel all these pains from the end clients, because the central bank by its nature is a bit different institution. And so we really need this close cooperation to address and to define the most important features, disregard of the how challenging time is, because every time is bringing like different challenges. But at the same time, if the really stable and good instrument, it should work in any time. And we also should look into the future, not only how to address this tough period, but also how to address already the recovery. I hope this helps.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting what you mentioned about offline payments, because offline payments are often quoted as one of the advantages that actually CBDCs can offer that cryptocurrencies, for example, can't necessarily. Of course, cash can, but that's and that is central bank backed. However, of course, crypto assets wouldn't be. And that background given, is anonymity also something? And this relates back to another question that we actually got. So, how far will it be possible to pay with eHervnia in an anonymous manner, given that this is also one of the design features that a CBDC could have as an advantage over other forms of money?
I believe to address the anonymity, it's really one of the most difficult questions what a central bank is facing. And here I would clearly define the anonymity from the privacy, because of course privacy is something that is important, and everyone understands that without the certain level of privacy, the instrument will simply not be that very much interested to the end client. But at the same time, anonymity should be very well balanced with all financial monitoring aspects like KYC, AML aspects, especially if we are talking for such a challenging time that my country is nowadays facing, because financing terrorism could be in place, you know. and the having the that level of anonymity. But at the same time, it could be addressed from another point of view. If it is an easy entry point, it may help maybe financial inclusion, which is crucially important to some people nowadays to have this access to the some like cash-like instrument. It's really very much to balance and the area where, of course, you know, we are not still that far. We are back to the theoretical phase, and it's really hard to address how the particular situation could influence the future, because I believe it's really one of the most biggest implications for the central banks in general. Thank you.
Okay, so no definite answer just yet on that one, as you said, basically turning back to the question that you've already internally probably discussed at the National Bank of Ukraine, but given the situation now, you have to reconsider kind of how could a crisis then affect the future of anonymity altogether. But that's the last question now for today, just to be wary of our time. And after hearing from you, Katarina, now about the current developmental phase of the eHrvnia, we will be turning over to the panel discussion now, which will be divided into two parts. The first part will be very much in line with the event title, so Digital Money in Times of Crises. It will be mainly points that our panelists deem to be of importance to questions such as the role of money in times of crises. And in the second part, so in the last 15 minutes, we will direct some of the audience's question towards the discussion round and the panelists. As we've mentioned before, make sure to use Slido for this, and you can also include the name of the panelist that you want to direct the question at. Just as a reminder, the number for the Slido was 6423, or you can head over to Slido and put that in there. And it's also posted in the LinkedIn comments if you just want to click the link, and it will take you there automatically. And that's it from in terms of disclaimers, let's say, before we get started with our first question that I'd like to pose to all of our panelists today, which will be, which role does money have in times of crises? So this can be anything from cash, CBDCs, to crypto assets or cryptocurrencies and the likes.
So I could start with this interesting question. So actually, the role of money in normal times is medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. And basically, money should fulfill these functions also in times of crisis. And in normal times, these functions are fulfilled by deposit money, so bank money, and by cash, less so by cryptocurrencies. Now, from a consumer perspective, the general experience is that money does often lose part of its value in times of crisis. Because, for example, the public sector needs the money to put through its priorities, printing more money, and this could obviously generate inflation, capital flight, a financial crisis by itself, and could mean that the foreign exchange rate is sent down, provoking even more inflation and so on. And this is the moment where the store of value function may not be fulfilled anymore. And I think that in this moment, deposit money is mostly takes the first hit because the banking sector could be destabilized. And if inflation gets out of hand in such a situation, the medium of exchange function would be endangered too, which means that actual cash of the national currency may also lose its appeal. And that is the moment where consumers are looking for alternatives, are starting to looking for alternatives. So they may look at foreign currencies like dollar or euro, or they may also look for cryptocurrencies. So to alternatives, so they look for alternatives which in usual times do look rather unattractive, but in such times of crisis, they could look attractive in relative terms. And obviously, there is a kind of network effect which could start to work. So the more people switching to certain foreign currencies or to certain cryptocurrencies, the more convenient it will be to use them. We know this from the phenomenon of dollarization or euroization in many emerging economies, including Ukraine, as far as I know. So we could witness a stable coinization, for example, if there is a reliable stable coin where to move into. That would be the perspective of the customer of an individual on the function of money.
The only thing I would add to Cyrus's point is that obviously this is the presumption is you have a ongoing or working infrastructure. And, one of the things that we've always contend with if you are on the government side is what if the, and this is not related to cryptocurrency per se or CBDCs, but if the banking system were to be in jeopardy for whatever reason, you are in a financial crisis where the draw of cash creates runs, and then you have to impose capital controls. It's something that we had seen in Greece, for example. Then you find that the entire infrastructure becomes challenged, right? And so I think to Cyrus's point, when you have a crisis like that, because crises, of course, come in so many different flavors. I mean, there's natural crises, there are economic crises, there's war, there's all sorts. But to Cyrus's point, that when you have a circumstance where the infrastructure is challenged, either because you can't use your portal, the internet's down, Wi-Fi is down, cellular connectivity is down, very much the behavior of the natural person is to say, I will go with what I have, which is cash or cash equivalent. And the second thing is that I usually, as Cyrus mentioned, that under those circumstances, you'll be trying to essentially get out of that cash into a third party cash or a third party fuel currency, which then brings Katerina's point around interoperability between exchange. Can I exchange what I have into something else? And so if primitively you would do it just by hand, right? I'll give you dollars or I didn't, and you give me something else. If you have an operating system, whether it's CBDCs or similar, and you have it interoperable to something else, this would probably be a circumstance where you would have an additional challenge, I think Cyrus is alluding to, of what happens if you end up having local sellers of the local currency trying to buy something else, say euros or dollars, when in fact that would exacerbate the macroeconomic situation in country. Which it's the derivative of bank runs, right, Cyrus? Because if people are now suddenly leaving a currency to something else or a different format, you'll end up actually benefiting one and deficiting the other. And this is in a micro scale. This is one of the reasons why one concern that people have had in the creation of a CBDC is that people would say, you know what, there's so much more protection in a CBDC under a bank run. You know, maybe under certain circumstances, I need to, leave my bank deposits and fill up my CBDC account to the maximum. And obviously, if everyone procyclically does the same thing at the same time, that leads to an outcome that's obviously undesirable. So these are just one of the things that I was just going to add to Cyrus's point.
I'd also like to take a step back and look at the traditional financial system in times that when it's not in a crisis. We know that cross-border payments are slow, inefficient, they're costly. I think recent estimates have put over 2 billion people around the world as unbanked or underbanked. I think that's 2 billion unbanked, let alone many more that are underbanked. And for those of us who fall inside that walled garden of financial services, there's still a universal lack of interoperability and openness. And that's in normal times. And then you put a level of stress and crisis on top of that, and it becomes more difficult to send and receive money. It becomes more difficult to receive financial services. The rails on which our modern financial services are built on are over 50 years old and haven't been updated since then. So I think digital assets and other advancements in the fintech spaces are overcoming a lot of these challenges. And we're really seeing an incredible time of private sector innovation, which might help in times of normalcy and certainly in times of crisis.
Yeah, colleagues already really described a lot of the issue of money in crisis. And of course, I also want to add some more a bit maybe academic or central banker's point of view. But at the same time, I want to start with the disclosure. You know, it's like a traditional one from the central bankers that all the commands provided during this discussion, and also it addressed the questions after my presentations. It was like my personal point of view, and they are not necessarily representatives of the central bank in our management. So regarding the role of money in crisis, the money is first of all a public good. How they are called is the glue of the financial system. And I believe disregard of the time money are defined and their role are defined through the very basic functions that are defined according to the like economic series, either three or six of them, but most common approach is so that they should serve as a medium of exchange, which means that it is something that people can use to buy and sell to each other, that it is unit of account, that is provide a common base of price, that it is the store of value, which means that people can save it and use it later, so smoothing their purchase over time. And the other function that is also the standard for deferred payment. At the same time, if we will have a look to the evolution of money in terms of instrument, mechanism, and forms, we would notice that every and each deep crisis or transformation lead to some also transformation in the forms, either forms or mechanisms or instruments that money could provide. And I believe that current period is really characterized that functions of money could be performed with the non-money instruments, for example, like crypto, in a particular with the stable coins. And it may bring both challenges and opportunities that should be addressed from different point of view. The private sector has like its own drive to facilitate this, the regulators, another one, the academia, the third one. And I believe the synergy would bring us to some really nice outcomes.
So why don't we continue right where you left off, Katerina? I like what you said about especially privately issued digital forms of money, right? And you were, I think, saying the advantages and disadvantages it may bring. So this might be good to focus on next. In particular, which benefits can privately issued money, so digital forms of money, of course, have for consumers in times of crisis, in your opinion? So think regional commodity money, stable coins, like you've mentioned before, Glenn as well.
Yes, absolutely, Sarah. It's really, of course, depend. But, you know, among the most benefits that are coming to the mind, it's, of course, the easy and widespread digital access that digital money could provide to the consumers. Also, the very nice, sometimes even really great, to be honest, consumer experience. That is supported also by these digital instruments, including the digital identification, because without this, it would be not possible to have some forms of digital money. Among downsides, we should consider like maybe some lack of stability that could be in place, a kind of a lack of trust for the certain institutions that are issuing the this private form of money. But of course, from the regulator's point of view, talking about privately issued money, we should clearly define the digital, like digital money that a two-tier banking system nowadays providing, simply like classic cashless money, from the new forms like stable coins. Even though this, most of them like claims, it's a claim of the private institution, but for the classic system of the classic banking, it has a lot of like risk preventing mechanism, like requirements, regulatory requirements. And for the newly appeared form, it's still in progress. It's still under focus. And that's why it's really a bit difficult to combine different part of the digital form of money. And even apart from this, you know, defining, for example, stable coin may vary from stable coin because they could be backed by something completely different, not only institutional wise, but at the same time, asset wise. And it's upon the consumer to address all the risks. Thank you. I believe the colleagues would add more.
No, I couldn't support Katerina more. I mean, she's absolutely right. The development and what do we know for sure? We know for sure that if new formats, be it CBDCs or stablecoins, were to come forward, there as adoption is as you see enhanced adoption, what will inevitably happen, I think, is that you will get a lot of you will have new suites of products and services that will emerge that will support it, right? I mean, it's sort of the natural, if you will, element that you create a sufficiently robust billboard and you will find a lot of people will start putting ideas onto it. In this case, apps and so forth will surely develop in and around that community that supports that particular, if you will, format. So Katerina mentioned earlier on retail cashless in the various different formats that it could take. I could well imagine different products and services under normal conditions would blossom and come forward to address different markets. So I'd be inclined to support what Katerina mentioned around the opportunities and the risks, but I suspect that you'll find that there are a lot of clever people who will find new, if you will, products and services to effectively serve that community with that particular format, be it stablecoin, CBDC, or otherwise.
I would love to.
Okay, Caroline, you, please.
I would just like to agree and echo what Katerina mentioned about stability and trust. Those two things are critical for whatever payment system or digital asset somebody is using. And obviously the word stable is built in the name of stable coins. But we all know that not all stable coins are in fact stable coin, they're stable. And not all stable coins have been created equally. And without that stability, without that trust that whatever I put into that stable coin, I can pull out, it will be challenging for adoption. We at Circle find that trust really important, which is why we are completely transparent and open with our reserves. But furthermore, we find that the trust and stability, something that we look forward to working with governments to ensure that stablecoins are brought under a responsible regulatory regime for prudential management. That way, users can have increased trust in what stablecoin they're using. And furthermore, stablecoins can then maintain that very important balance of the two-tiered financial system, the privately issued money that's already in circulation, and really allows a government to continue their monetary policy without disruption. Stablecoins, in our view, are an additive to that system already, and should be well regulated by governments to ensure that they are, again, transparent, stable, and able to deliver a lot of those benefits that we've already touched on.
Yeah, I may add on that. So I would like to emphasize also what Katerina says with respect to the difference of bank deposits and stable coins. I think it's very important to understand that bank deposits are obviously, well, in a way, they are stable coins in the sense that they promise to be exchanged against cash, actual cash, so central bank money, at 1-to-1. They usually are also covered by a deposit insurance system. Stable coins, or the most of them, are covered by bank deposits. So it's another step back. So obviously there is a quality or a difference in quality in looking at the safety of these two kinds of money. Looking at the benefits that privately issued digital forms of money can have for consumers, I would say, well, if the banking sector works fine, then the privately issued bank deposits, which is privately money, can obviously be used in the normal way, and all is okay. However, if banks are exposed to the crisis, this could mean problems with the payment system, which usually relies very much on the banking sector. And then comes the central bank in. If there is problems with the bank due to liquidity reasons, then the central bank can jump in and provide this liquidity, which is once again another buffer to the banking system. However, if you have a bank which is hit so hard by the crisis that all the assets are of no value anymore, then it would be irresponsible for the central bank to cover and to rescue such a bank. Then people would have to look at other alternatives. And this could be also, apart from stablecoins, it could be also native cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ether, obviously with a caveat that there you have still a very high volatility and you can lose by this scheme or by this mechanism part of your money. But on the other hand, you can still store it more easily or independently from crisis hit institutions, which usually should work, but in crisis may not.
I guess, Cyrus, you're referring to the credit component of it, aren't you? Because fundamentally, you're describing, you know, anything that's backed by something is fundamentally a credit
back. Right. Well, it's backed by a promise, let's say.
Yes.
The deposits are backed by a promise.
Yes.
And only a fraction of really central bank money. But they are backed by a promise and the deposit insurance system.
Yes, which
so do... after a certain amount, the central the deposit insurance system ensures that you get your money.
Which alludes to Caroline's point that if you have an environment where an entity, say USDC, were to be not only it falls under the regulatory, if you will, framework. That and were to also include, if you will, the benefits of having depositor insurance coverage, then a lot of this could also be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because absolutely. Effectively it becomes pari passu, right, with what otherwise we would call a conventional bank.
No, true. Absolutely. You can have also stable coins designed in a way that they are the crypto version of deposits, usual bank deposits. Yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Which is where Katrina was, I think, alluding to, is if you look at a two-tier structure, you could end up having, let's say, I'm making this up, everyone, so I'm just sort of talking out loud, where the USDC part, or the, let's call it the stable component, stable coin component, be it issued by a private entity, or in fact a bank, or an entity like Caroline's outfit, were to find itself under the regulatory umbrella, then the next layer above that would be where the CBDC would, if you will, live, if you mm-hmm. get my logic, right? So the parallel would be reserves is to cash, right? As CBDC, or rather, CBDCs are to cash, as stable coins are to, let's say, bank money.
Right? Yeah, it could be the outcome, right?
Yeah, in a kind of sort of very, very crude analogy, I taking what Katrina said and what Caroline said, I could see the two coexist. because this would enable the providers, if you will, of, let's say, all derivatives of CBDCs that, let's say, the bank or the bank related regulated community possesses, then offers all sorts of different other, if you will, private payment formats. They could all coexist because all of it will still, if you will, sit and or rest upon the CBDC element, which had now otherwise replaced the word reserves.
Mm-hmm.
This could then enable, you know, lots of different, if you will, formats to flourish, right? Katerina mentioned about the concept of, Sarah, you used the word voucher. This was exactly the format that was done post-war here in the UK, where people were basically, in order to get them to stimulate the economy, they were given certificates in order to expend, but they can only spend in certain ways. Yeah, they also expired. So they were literally exploding certificates that if you didn't use it for food stuffs, for utility, you know, for basic goods, they would expire useless. And this was a means to pump prime the economy, which is something that for a central banker, and I'm, Kendra, if you don't mind, I'm putting words in your mouth, but if I were a central banker, this is a wonderful tool to have in my arsenal, yeah, to be able to say, look, here is a quote, call it a programmable money that I can pinpoint elements into the economy to drive, if you will, an outcome. And you don't use it, you don't use it. But in a COVID circumstance, we could easily have seen how that would have been more direct drive and how that could have been massively more beneficial had this had a structure like this existed. Same concept, I think, Caroline, I think you'd agree with me that would have been a wonderful tool to have used if it were available. And I think going forward, I could imagine that will come into fruition. And that in turn will then enable central bankers to administer in a way that we probably have not seen before. And it would then allow entities like Circle and others to create different, if you will, means of programmable money that we really have never even seen before, except in crude paper formats in the past, like food stamps or credit vouchers, right? I could easily see something like that emerge.
It's a kind of approach that Silvio Gesell proposed 100 years ago or so.
Exactly.
When he proposed money with maturity.
Yes.
And actually, the ECB did something quite similar with negative interest rates.
Both that and the concepts like QE, if you have a term limit time, it is effectively a format of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sorry, we're going way. We're moving into macroeconomy. So I'll reserve that. Apologies.
So, but Cyrus, you can rest assured I'm going to quote you on the ECB's equivalent regarding negative interest rates. Great. If we could now come to, and you've already touched on this a little bit, so I don't think there's going to be any difficulty here, and also getting into the debate, but if we come to publicly issued monies in times of crises, what are the benefits and the downsides that you see with CBDCs?
If I may start here. The CBDC as the publicly issued digital money. So I believe we are a bit running out of time, so I would structure my answer in a very like two really brief comment. On the one hand side, like a benefit, right? CBDC, by its definition, it's a direct claim to the central bank. So in being this direct claim, CBDC could provide like an increase, more trust and stability, so-called resilience for the financial system and for the end user. But on another hand side, talking about the downsides or drawbacks, it could disrupt the banking system in such a model. But the banking system, especially in time of crisis, is very important to have the sustainable functioning banking system, because it's really like the key pillar of the healthy economy at any time, especially at crisis. Of course, it could be mitigated by a two-tier model that should be and considered by almost all the central banks. And at the same time, both of the benefits and the drawback that I mentioned, they address in the retail side of the CBDC. But we all know that retail is not only one on this stage is the wholesale, and a lot of interesting experiments are happening also in this wholesale, especially cross-border dimension. And maybe this area could also can address the time of crisis, because this cross-border aspect in terms of remittances, in terms of just cross-border payments, they're also important in crisis. Yeah, thank you.
I think generally, CBDCs, the benefits of CBDCs, which we've all heard before, are already being met a lot of times by private sector innovations, and letting governments continue to spend years researching these to then choose technology winners and losers that then doesn't continue to innovate might end up hurting us more in the long run. In addition to some of the concerns already mentioned today, I want to underscore the privacy concerns of a CBDC. This is certainly not something that we should pay as much attention to in a responsible government, but we know that in times of crisis, financial privacy is incredibly important for IDPs, for refugees, for anyone of political opposition. There's also honeypot concerns, where we've seen governments be hacked, and all that financial data living at a central bank might be concerning. I think it's we should be designing the future of the financial system to be the same in a period of crisis and in a period of normalcy. The last thing I think we'd want anyone to do when they're facing this instability at home is to then try to learn a new financial system or a new form of money, and how do I send it and how do I receive it. So whatever is being built, I think, should be built in a way that achieves both of those goals. I've also already mentioned today the challenges that a CBDC might put on the two-tiered banking structure, the downward pressure on deposits, the increased form of distrust that somebody might come to government-issued payments. All of those things seem quite challenging as countries look to design a CBDC.
Yeah, maybe I add some points to the aforementioned issues. So generally, we are experiencing in many countries that actual cash is diminishing in use, and which means that access to real central bank money is going down, and in times of crisis, it may be even more difficult to get access, depending on the crisis. But let's assume it's a crisis where you really have difficulties to access an ATM or use actual cash. And then CBDC obviously could be an advantage in having still access to central bank money and send this online via my digital account if it was designed as a account-based CBDC, for example. And it could have another advantage for times of crisis in the sense that we could build a CBDC system as a redundant payment system. So if the payment system, which relies today very much on the banking sector, does not work anymore because a systemic bank drops out of the system due to whatever reason, then the big catastrophe that the whole payment system doesn't work anymore could be avoided by having this redundant system based on CBDC accounts, which could make a country much more resilient towards such a crisis. So I think that this, in terms of what advantages CBDC could have in times of crisis, these are I think, important points.
All right, so we see slightly varied perspectives on the question of benefits and downsides that CBDCs, and then especially you raised the whole retail wholesale debate actually here as well. But I'm expecting no less various answers for our next section, which is going to focus on CBDCs as a defense mechanism and whether it's the state's responsibility. And the first question I'd like to ask to all of you would be, should states provide a CBDC as a defense mechanism in times of crises? Everybody wants to answer first.
Yeah, then I will go ahead. It's really amazing question, Sarah, you know, and I believe what should be really considered that major number of countries are on an early stage of CBDC research. So not even everyone working on the design already of the CBDC, but only considering. And of course, we should understand the need for CBDC, so goal of its introduction, will influence like so-called design feature and vice versa. For example, the already mentioned benefits, like as the programmability, direct claim, if we are talking about the retail, and the aspect that could address really very well the cross-border payments and enhance this development and enhance cooperation with the countries, should and may address the challenges by the wholesale or multi-CBDC arrangements, like the Project Jura, like the Enbridge project. At the same time, if we are talking about the really defense mechanism, and it means that the tough time, terrible challenges, the aspects such as cybersecurity should be really on the top priority, and the innovative technology, like as any new technology, could bring a lot of challenges in terms of cybersecurity, cyber risks that should be mitigated. I already mentioned during the previous discussion this disintegration of financial system and how it should be addressed. So it's really hard to say yes or no, because each country varies from each country. They have all countries have completely different financial infrastructure already that existing at the moment. The challenges are different, but of course the current situation would reshape entire payment landscape, and it will put more in place the possibility to the newly appearing like multi-platform maybe for the cross-border payments. But at the same time, we understand that still it should be balanced between the equality and possibility to regulate this entrance. For example, if we are talking about developing something similar on a bigger scale, like an Enbridge project, where it's like a cross-countries platform for the multilateral CBDC agreement, then every country should have a right. But if who should be owner, and where should be this notary note, what limitations should be? I believe it would be really fair if every country could apply particular rules for the within the country, and then it would work as a consensus for the like extension of this global landscape. But it's really a big step for the future, and it's really hard to say yes or no, because it depends on many, many factors that are already in place and the challenges that may arrive and the design features that CBDC could have that either it would address or maybe not at all. If it would be replicate the system, then what would be the benefits? Even if it would have some extra features, but they would not address particular aspects of the country. So it's really more the question of the combination of right design for the right purpose. Of course it could, but should or not, everyone should decide upon the existing criteria that are in place and the infrastructure that are operating.
I think Katerina makes a very good point that echoes what Cyrus mentioned, is that, Sarah, your question around in crises, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to do or to implement, you, as they say, on a good day, let alone on a really bad day. So that's point one. Point two would be, but were some format were to have been put in place, as Cyrus says, as a contingency, that would be embedded into a rollout of a CBDC in any case. As far as where, you know, is there an obligation I think those are the words you're looking for. Is there an obligation or a right or a necessity for the state to do so? I mean, surely there would be a necessity for the function of the economy to have an ability to retain, if you will, sovereignty over its money and the ability to exchange and to put value in goods and so forth. So I think it's a given that the state would look at something. But would it necessarily lead to a CBDC in times of crisis? I'm not so sure that's the question so much as I would look at it upside down. The question would be, would it not want to have that in place so as to be ensured that in a crisis it would have a backup? So I looked at it almost the other way around, if you will.
In the United States, the Federal Reserve, as I think we all know, is going through their own research project on issuing a US CBDC. And I found one thing interesting in the discussion paper that they put out this year around issuing a CBDC in a time of crisis, which noted just the potential for a run on commercial deposits at financial institutions if individuals think a CBDC or US CBDC, in the case of the Federal Reserve, of course, is more trustworthy, is more stable, than the commercial bank deposits that they hold. And the the ramifications of a bank run during a period of crisis, I think we can all imagine how exponentially worse that would make whatever the crisis is. So just wanted to point to that as an interesting note.
Well, I think I go more in line with Kim. So I would say it would be, if I understood you right, so I think it would be wise to have CBDC in place just in case that you run into a crisis. And this may also involve to have a partnership with other countries, be it for the reason that you set up servers which are running the CBDC, not only in your country, but also in countries outside your country, so that you are more resilient against natural catastrophes or war or other things that may destroy the service. So this could be one thing to have really or to take into account. And the other thing is, we already talked about it, international payments. I think that given that the current system of international payments is rather complicated because it goes through the banking or through different banks. If you make international payments, you have to use the correspondent banking network, and this can take 3 days, 4 days for a payment because there is no direct connection between the banks in the two countries. And if you have crisis, this may take even longer or may even not be possible. So you can really circumvent it by having direct CBDC connections. So, for example, a German company wants to import goods from Ukraine from Ukraine, for example, but the payment will be rather difficult to do because the bank in Ukraine is not accepted by the other banks as a payment partner, for example, then to set up a CBDC account for Ukrainian money, for hryvnia, at the German company, so that you can have a direct connection with the exporter of Ukraine. Well, it may be an idea to have and to make the economy more resilient to such a situation.
I mean, sorry, this is parallels to when you get currency swap arrangements between central banks. You know that a couple of years ago, well, there's lots of them, but a couple of years ago, for example, in the Nordic space, the Danes, the Swedes, the Norwegian, they basically entered into one where they had a mutual currency swap facility between themselves. That would be a parallel to what you're describing, because the idea was that in times of crises where they needed to have access to certain currencies, that they wouldn't find themselves out of it, right, at the worst possible time, thereby reinforcing that they have access would hopefully be a preventative, if you will, measure to be taken in advance in time, you know, in less volatile times. So to me, that could be a parallel that could be established were a CBDC to be established, that there would be some arrangement with others that where a certain degree of interoperability would be in place, or at least that would be the access of that would be in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, again, we got a good idea of actually both sides of the coin. No pun intended on this one, actually. And in closing, I would like to ask you one last question from my side, at least, before we'll turn over to the audience, which is actually going to be, which type of money do you reckon will be the most crisis resistant in 10 years' time? And I expect the question to be raised again, what crisis resistant means from your side again.
But if I would start with a really short comment, in my point of view, and I believe that it will be a coexistence. So it would be the combination of all their forms of money, and they could address different challenges in different times. And they could serve simply different purpose, different group of populations, and address different aspects even at the same time of crisis. Diversity, it's all about it. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree that we will have different forms of money, but I doubt that we can make a general statement about this is the most stable in general, because I think it depends very much on the country we're talking about. So it's money is a whole construct of institutions and their stability. And if you have a country with very unstable institutions, you can have the best design of money, it won't work. And on the other hand, you can have very good institutions, and the central bank may have 2 years of doing really a bad job, but still the money will survive. So it's for me, it's a very dependent on the stability of the institutions of this country.
I'm afraid I actually have to sit with Cyrus on this because it really is built upon, if you will, the perception of trust, right? That's a perception, right? which we get reinforced every day with usage. And if that trust is undermined, be it in the crisis or by circumstances, you know, externalities, these things will undermine the value as relative to other, if you will, currencies. And it could be, as we had seen recently in one of the alternate stablecoins, there were questions about what is the underpinning, what are the underpinning components of that stablecoin. Or it could be on, you know, a tweet by a particular person that we had. I mean, any of these could have severe impacts on any given moment. But as far as longevity and substance, I think to Cyrus's point, this is why, in general, central banks take very, very small, very deliberate, very cautious steps to build, if you will, their structures. And as they all embark, and we all know that there are literally hundreds of different, if you will, projects all over the world exploring, if you will, various formats of CBDC, if you will, issuance, rollout strategies, and so forth. It seems to me that what we can say is that the completion, if you will, of the digital payment system will probably emerge sometime relatively soon. and that that central banks will take these choices very, very cautiously in general, and very deliberately. They will no doubt use pilot programs to seek, if you will, and engineer test, if you will, their formats. And I'm optimistic myself that, you know, multiple of them will emerge, but they will be reflective of the, of their individual economies. Then I'm not yet convinced that there is one format that rules them all, if you will, because I think it needs to be reflective of the economies and the structures and the institutions that they have within them.
Well, it seems like the four of us are all centralizing around this idea of trust and stability, which I think is very telling in what the future looks like. Of course, as an issuer of a stablecoin, USDC, you know, we have seen users flock to USDC in times of instability in crypto markets, but also in times of crisis when remittances are challenging to send. And we've even partnered with, you know, the U.S. government to provide financial services in hard to reach places. So what will come is probably no surprise, but I think that in 10 years, what will the most crisis resistant will be, again, a form of money that people can trust in being interoperable, can trust in providing the value that they need, and is going to give that stable value.
All right. I think everybody made their statement. We'll look back in 10 years and see however we can assess the assertions that you just made about which will be the most crisis resistant money. But again, as we've seen, of course, that depends on the crisis itself, the person that you're looking at, rules and regulation around it. But that will conclude the panel discussion portion of today's session. We're going to be turning over to the Q&A session that will involve all of you again, but with questions from the audience this time. And the first question is actually directed towards Cyrus. And you were touching on assets, specifically stablecoin, Cyrus, that we're dealing with bank deposits or some type of deposit backing them. And the question is, what about tokenizing bank deposits themselves rather than basing stablecoins on bank deposits?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that this could be a way to accelerate the access to blockchain-based money, given that the central banks are somewhat moving quite slowly, and there is some demand in the industrial sector to have such a kind of money, and obviously this could be a step taken by banks. What I think it would be important is that you do not have as many standards as you have banks in your country, but instead that the banks cooperate and look for a standard that the tokens are really interoperable and that they run not necessarily on the same blockchain but on interoperable blockchains. And yeah, I think that's certainly a possibility to have in the future.
And Cyrus, wouldn't you have thought also that we would have another problem on each one of the let's call it the backing of that particular coin would be back to the original bank, which is backed by those original deposits. So we're back to the question we had talked about before, which is the credit risk component, right? Because you're still going to be even if you had the perfect construction, you're still at the end of the day, you distill it down to the same credit risk of those deposits in that particular bank.
Yeah, you mean if you trade this token, which is issued by, let's say, Bank X?
So Bank A issues a token based on the deposits that it has, right? Mm-hmm. Bank B receives that token and exchanges for another. So the at the end of the day, though, we're still you strip out the actual coin itself. You're really looking at two different sets of depositors at two different banks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To your point about homogeneity, it would be great if they were all identical, right? And the one place where you could get homogeneity is up back to what you referred to before, which is the depositor insurance component. Because if the depositor insurance component canvassed the entire community up to 100,000 or 200,000, whatever number you have, and the coin that was delivered backed upon that, backed by that depositor insurance, effectively is fungible between them all.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, I could imagine, right? That would enable a coin to exist backed by those deposits, but freely, if you will, be homogeneous to travel in between these various banks, simply because the backing it has from the deposit insurance is the same.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would say a short answer to that. I think that in this sense, the technical standards about how this token works should be very much, well, should be very safe, but the deposits must be in a kind of narrow money manner.
Yes, yes.
Must be,
yes,
really, well, not be used for other purposes in the meantime.
No, I can't. You don't want to have situations where it's been hypothecated for all these other uses. So yes, they have to be ring fenced so that this is the purpose for
it. Right.
Otherwise, you'll end up doubling it by accident, or tripling it, or quadrupling it, and so forth. I agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. We're moving on to the next question by the audience, which is asking about whether crises, and the person didn't specify necessarily what they mean here, but whether crises can actually make the risk of disintermediation for banks more severe. So if people are more turning towards crypto assets and private types of issued money, so corporation or by people, do you perceive that as a risk to monetary monopolies of a country?
I think what we have seen is that a fiat-backed stablecoin would still allow a country to conduct monetary policy in times of normalcy or crisis that it would normally.
Well, in emerging economies, a flight to the kind or all sorts of stable coins or cryptocurrencies is obviously a risk for the stability of this country. Like every time that you have capital flight out of the local currency, you have an exchange rate risk. The exchange depreciates. This means higher inflation, and this destabilizes the country. This is obviously a risk, but it's a risk that is already, even without cryptocurrencies, is already there, because you have alternatives like dollar, like euro, like pound, and so on. And so I'm not sure if this risk is really increased by the existence of stable coins and other cryptocurrencies, or if this is more or less the same risk than before.
I mean, capital flight is something that exists already without any of these coins. That exists, and small open liberal economies are, you know, small economies, really small ones, are always at risk on that, because if they have certain dynamics that are, if you will, less than productive for their country, they can find themselves bankrupt relatively quickly, and then you end up having the imposition of capital controls. So that's something that is that coexists, if you will, already today, even without any form of digital money. And it's a risk that I think has been talked to by a number of IMF-related programs, World Bank programs around small emerging countries. What, you know, they want to join the larger, if you will, trading world. But they also leave themselves open if they don't have their own developed capital markets to absorb absorb, if you will, the flows that will occur, the carry trades that may occur, the all sorts of different, flows that could unbeknownst to an operator, can undermine them tremendously. I mean, you saw that in the late 90s in Asia. You see that in circumstances, say, Iceland in, just after, on the preceding the global financial crisis. You know, you can name them, and that's without having a stable coin. That's without having CBDCs. But these are just simply flows that exist anyway. In fact, it'd be one of the things that I think someone like in Katerina's position would be very mindful of, because they know that, you know, those are the risks that have preceded in the history of smaller economies have been challenged a great deal, because let's say a large economy have obviously obligations to its own bloc. You know, the ECB is responsive to the Eurozone, right? The Fed is primarily responsible for the U.S. economy. The fact that another economy either legs it or in any way has a linked currency or a currency peg is important, but it's not the primary. It's not of their primary concern. So that's another element of interoperability that would also have to be addressed.
In my point of view, the risk of disintermediation during the crisis, the most risk may come from the central bank, because it really brings to the team from the central bank digital currencies, like issued digital currencies issued by the central bank, because it really, like by its essence, bringing to the table something new as a direct claim to the central bank that may be beneficial for the end consumers during the crisis. Of course, the central bank should be very concerned and address it properly, not to disrupt this innovation. It's very important, and I believe everyone understands this. But if we are talking about the disintermediation that are caused by the privately issued digital money, like form of digital currencies, virtual assets, whatever, and it depends from what area you come in, you call them differently, but that's the idea just the same. I believe it's more in the good times, because the still it's the more risks in terms of classical understanding, and usually people are more reluctant and more ready to accept this risk on the good times. That's why I really believe that it depends on the times. But both forms of digital money could be a risk for the traditional banking and financial system. Thank you.
Great. I wish we could continue our discussion right where we're leaving off now, because we actually have to come to a closing just now. But before wishing everybody a good evening, I would like to thank all of you panelists, first and foremost, of course, and especially Katerina, on sharing your perspective during the current times. We stand united as much as we can, obviously, with Ukraine and the people of Ukraine, if I may say so on behalf of the DIA, Caroline shaking her head. I think you were all, though, able to add valuable perspectives to the topic, and we hope to welcome you again on future DIA panels. As for anybody watching, make sure to keep the conversation going by both reaching out to our panelists and the DIA by signing up to our newsletter via our website, and follow us for CBDC and stablecoin related content on all of our social media channels, so LinkedIn and Twitter, which is at DigiEuro, our handle. And that being said, thank you again for joining today's event, and we hope to see you all again soon. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.